This is the first episode of my podcast, And Now What? There's many ways I could have started this, and honestly, this is not what I had in mind at first. I am at this point in my life less of an academic and more of a teacher of political theory. In the end, I'm not really interested in the intricacies of interpretations, the minute differences of academic debate. Political theories matter to me, and I think should matter to you, because of what they do. In the simplest terms, political theories shape how we think of our common world, and about how we should and can live together. That is why I love the history of ideas. The history of ideas is what we call the study of the worldviews people held before we held ours. I like the history of ideas because it teaches me three things. First, people used to think very differently, and they were quite confident in their views. Maybe people believing very different things about how we should live together is normal. Secondly, my views, and in fact anyone's views, in many ways reflect concepts, ideas, and theories that we haven't thought up, but that are actually much older, have their own story to tell. We are not nearly as original, progressive, or rational as we think. Thirdly, and maybe most importantly, we can change the way we think. And by doing that, we can change the political options available to us. It's been done before. Of course, changing how we think about the world doesn't change it all by itself. That is hard work. But the world has only ever really changed when people thought about their challenges in a new way and explored options they had previously rejected or not even seen. So reflecting on why we think the way we do and possibly changing that is a start. I also happen to think it can be fun to flex your brain muscles, to consider the pros and cons, and then ask yourself, and now what? And that now leads me to where I chose to start this journey. Last semester I taught a course in crisis thinking. I thought, if it's not a thing, it should be. I assembled a reading list that fits the bill, and voila! I will make an episode on this course because it was beyond cool, seriously. Today, I will just talk about the first academic text I assigned and what came from it. The text was Hope Adjuring Hope by Matthias Thaler, and while a good academic text, it is not itself particularly groundbreaking. However, this goes to show how sometimes things spitball from one idea in a debate. Anyway, in the text, Thaler argues for reconsidering the role of utopian thinking in political theory. It kind of has a bit of a bad name for being wishful thinking. Utopian thinking, he says, always has to look beyond the here now and imagine alternatives. And alternatives to reality need to be imaginable, which is how utopias can enrich more realist approaches. His argument is more sophisticated, of course, and I'll put a link in the blog for anyone who would like to read more. Utopian thinking is usually considered political thinking because it does at least two things. On the one hand, there's a critique of the status quo, of what is. And on the other, an alternative is presented based on a different set of priorities or values, whichever you prefer. We see it in Utopia by Thomas More, written in the beginning of the 16th century, and you might have guessed this is where the term utopian thinking derives from. In Utopia, which translates as non-place, Thomas More takes the reader on a fictitious journey with an Englishman to the island of Utopia. People there live in ways so different from what the Englishman knows that he is quite amazed. The traveler ponders the differences to England and praises where Utopians found better solutions. Now, a quick shout out to fiction here, because it is a much underrated source of political thinking. Fiction as political thinking gives room for experimentation. It's just a story, so no one can blame you if it's unrealistic or doesn't quite work. Doing that, utopian fiction achieves something, if well done, quite remarkable, because it's not a political manifesto. At best, it aims to inspire. It doesn't rally a political movement. Fiction can remain messy and incomplete. The better world does not need to be perfect. The travelers to Utopia is taken aback by some of the stranger customs on the island, and Tala, in his example in the article, Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed, also sees how Le Guin describes the utopian planet as ambivalent, not a perfect world at all. Utopian thinking paints a picture of a future or a faraway place better than the here now, but not perfect, improved yet improvable. That is the beauty of fiction. All that is fun and good to know, important. But interestingly, it is not what stuck in the course I was teaching. What stuck was hope. It was brought up every week for the whole semester. Hope, too, in a pretty straightforward way, is part of Thaler's argument. Realism, he says, risks appearing fatalistic when it fails to consider alternatives to the status quo. Utopian thinking shows alternatives without denying reality and thereby makes hope possible. And this idea resonated deeply with the group. I was reminded of something Cory Doctorow wrote about optimism and pessimism a while ago. He argued both are really the same thing in reverse, one believing everything will get better no matter what, the other believing everything will get worse no matter what. Doctorow goes on to say that hope is a method, a necessary if insufficient condition for change. Hope is acting because you believe positive change is possible. Even if you cannot be certain, your actions will get you there. I will put the link to this article on the blog, and it is a fun read, but I am too much of an academic still to just take Doctorow's word for it. Did some more digging. Turns out there's actually something called hope theory. It is not political theory, nor, as you might have suspected, religious scholarship. What I found was psychological research. There's some interesting concepts there, which might be helpful. Charles Snyder, which could be called the father of hope theory, I guess, asked to put it simply why some people manage to improve their lives and others don't. And he showed that hope has a lot to do with it. The hope Snyder means has three components. It's important to consider all three, because for hope to be hope, they need to all come together. And I'll be adding my own political theory twist along the way. To have hope, one needs to have goals. Something that does not yet exist, but you wish it would. You need to the positive image of a world beyond the here and now. You need imagination. And if you want political change, you need to collectively imagine that future. Now, here we come back to one of the criticisms of utopian thinking. Utopias, or imaginations thereof, have been the driving force for many political movements. Sometimes these utopias become rigid ideas, ideologies, usually when they are themselves rigid, narrow, and detailed. You can think of your own examples. So utopias can go very wrong. But I'm focused on hope here, and there are some important things to say about the collective imaginings that support hope. They don't need to be awfully concrete. You don't need to agree on exactly which shape a climate-friendly world should take to collectively imagine it. You don't need to agree on what exact measures make a more just world. If you can agree, a more justice is what the world needs. Collective imaginings are still possible if we realize that our ideal worlds may differ. Maybe I can put it like this. All we need to really believe here is that either of our better futures is a step in a good direction. And if you think about it, even on the level of our own individual hopes and goals, these aren't made by us alone. They're made with others in conversation, others who encourage, enable, and support us. So, goal setting really is a collective exercise. Goals. Got that. Second, for hope to be real, you have to see a path towards the goal you seek. What you can imagine has to be possible, at least in theory. Some things become possible because you imagine them. Others do not. Even if we disagree on where the limit here lies, we can agree that if there is no conceivable way the goal could be achieved, there is no hope. Now, we don't have to see the exact or whole path, but I believe that seeing some concrete steps to take before you strengthens hope. Know what to do. Mind you, well, it's nice, politically speaking, to go for collective steps. That does not seem to be as important for the steps as for the goals. Many micro-actions create change every day, for good and bad. Many buyers who prefer SUVs to smaller vehicles change the world. So do people who choose to eat vegan, sometimes or always. Many dynamics result from individuals taking their own steps to achieve their own goals. The path to the goal you see can be messy. It can be narrow. It can be crowded. You can be the only one seeing it, or it can be one of many ways to achieve the goal. If it's there, there is hope. Now, the third element is the will to actually take that path. Collective action, that's what this screams to the political thinker. But again, we're not required to build a movement right here, now. We can, but hope covers all steps you're willing to take on your own as well. So hope is where you're willing to go the first steps, and then some more. That makes a lot of sense. If you do nothing of what would be required, you cannot really expect your wish to become reality. That's not hope. That's wishful thinking. But why should those small steps count? We all know that systemic change of some sort is needed to meet today's challenges. Small steps just don't cut it. It counts, because we're not alone. When I grew up in Germany in the 80s, there was a popular saying. It was called an African proverb, but I have no way of verifying if that's true. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just an invention of Germans too invested in do-good activism. Either way, and even if it sounds like a cheesy quote on an inspirational postcard, it points to one often overlooked point. Many people in many small places who take many small steps can change the face of the world. Sounds weird when translated, but you get the idea. Look beyond the cheesy formulation typical for proverbs. This really states an objective fact. Small steps can accumulate to systemic differences. They don't have to, but they might. The dynamics involved in our decision making and the way these possibly lead to changes at higher levels are very complex and indeed strange sometimes. Let me give an example. What is the strongest indicator of whether someone puts a solar panel on their roof? Government programs? Price? Hours of sunshine in the area? Surely all matter. But what really matters the most is whether your neighbor has one. Surprised? Ever since I heard that in the climate podcast, I'm looking and it really seems probable. Solar panels do seem to cluster. Ever since our neighbors got them, I've been thinking of ways we could fit one, even if our house is the wrong way around for that. I walk around and when I see one, I always see more. As if all people suddenly had the same idea. Small changes can pile up that way, and that is why small steps should count, too. Towards hope, that is. So long as people keep taking small steps toward whatever better world they want, there's hope. No more, no less. And to return to the beginning, that might be why we kept returning to hope in our class again and again. There isn't any easy, clear-cut solution to any of our crises. But to have hope, we don't need to have all the answers. We need a goal. We need to believe there's a way to get there, even if we can't see all the steps clearly. And we need the world to take those steps. Hope is in fact a strategy. Or rather, it's only hope when it's a strategy. All nice and well, but now what? As for me, I strongly believe that the way we see the world has great influence on how we act. Every one of us has a set of beliefs about how the world is that shapes what we believe is possible. In fact, believing in certain possibilities is what makes them possibilities in the first place. The history of ideas is full of such examples. So I've realized that one of the ways I can contribute to a world full of possibilities is opening up new interpretations of the world to more people. Some of these ideas might be odd, but they still give a new perspective to our world. They offer a viewpoint that makes options and paths visible that were obscured before. You see, I don't believe political thought progresses quite like science, where old models get thrown out as newer, better models are developed. Political thought works by addition. A new theory makes new things visible, sometimes because they newly emerged, sometimes because they finally caught attention, sometimes because someone simply decided to look right there. We consider ideas important because they speak to our lives and our challenges in our time. Having more perspectives and ideas at our disposal to throw at our problems gives us a better view, so to say. we see more options, more connections, and maybe think up some of our own. In this podcast, I will be sharing an eclectic mix of great ideas by very human thinkers and talk about why and how they can enrich our view of the world. All in the spirit of being helpful, I will start in the next episode with Machiavelli's conception of virtue. Because I find, once you look beyond the immediate context, it's as good as any self-help book you've ever read. Trust me. Until then, if you like this episode, please share with people, like it, and maybe subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss Machiavelli's take on getting through tough situations. Stay curious, interested, and hopeful. Bye now.